So, this is talking with Rod Davies at Grenoble on 30th August 76. So, can you tell me just a little bit about your background before you came to Jodrell Bank and when that was and so forth?
Yes, I went to the radio physics division of CSIRO in 1951.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jodrell's not first.
And then I worked with Christensen immediately when he was building his 32-element interferometer.
What was your training before then?
Before that, I was at Adelaide University. I'd done a degree in physics, an honours degree in physics at Adelaide
physics,
University.
Okay. Yes.
And my first job as a physicist was with the radio physics division,
right,
where Pawsey was head of the radio astronomy side. And I worked with Christensen on solar activity to start with, helped him with putting up the 32-element interferometer. And then worked with Piddington for quite a while on analysing a lot of data that accumulated in the radio physics division.
But that was it. Piddington was part of another group, is my understanding, is that right?
He was a theoretical person within the establishment there at CSIRO. He had interests in the ionosphere, the sun, and also later on in galaxies and galaxy formation and so on.
Quite controversial. Still does, yeah. Now, I see these two papers, Piddington and Davies, 53 in Monthly Notices in Nature.
Yes.
What were the issues that you were looking at that time?
Well, we were looking at the way in which the corona gets its heating. There's a problem which has only really recently been resolved, is how the energy transport occurs from the nuclear processes in the inside, but more specifically the photosphere up into the corona. Well, there are even suggestions that the heating was coming from outside, there was material falling into the sun. But we showed there was enough energy available in the radio hotspots, which previously hadn't been identified, with at least these gave you enough thermal energy, enough half rho v squared, to actually heat the corona.
I see.
In fact, I think it turns out now that that's incidental, that coincidence. The energy certainly is generated in these hotspot regions, but the transport is via sound waves.
Right.
The woofing out through the
energy.
Yeah, that's right.
And this idea was not around at all at that time.
No, I don't know when it began. No, it was substantially after that, after the time I had any close contact with that part of the field.
And then the comment in the abstract here was that if these sunspots heat the corona, then most thermal radio radiation is due to sunspots, and the quiescent level is very low. If you had a perfectly sunspotless sun,
you expected
that you would see a tremendous drop in the heat and the temperature of the corona.
Right. That background was thought to be purely the chromosphere radiating. I mean, that was what we thought the background would be, that there wasn't anything that was suprathermal, as it were. The stuff was essentially the tail off of the density and the temperature distribution as you went up from sun would quite adequately account for the quiet sun.
And therefore all frequencies to the plasma frequency of the chromosphere would measure the same brightness temperature.
Don't believe a word he says, old boy, right?
Dr. Henry Brown.
Yes, the coronal heating story, I think our main interest was looking at the variable component lower down and seeing whether this could explain the coronal background. But you've got to remember that the coronal temperature is 1,000,000 degrees and the chromosphere is 10,000. So as a complete radiator, you're getting a variation of brightness temperatures. You're saying, it would all look like 10,000. In fact, depending upon the wavelength you look at it, the wavelength the plasma frequency actually emits at,
yes,
will be 1,000,000 degrees at these other long wavelengths in 10,000 of those.
But on your idea, when the sunspots weren't there, you wouldn't see any 1,000,000 degrees. You'd only see the chromospheric temperature, wouldn't you?
Oh, I'm sorry. If you were able to get rid of the heating process altogether, the corona would disappear.
And that's what you thought would happen if there were no sunspots. Is that a fair statement?
It would degenerate into something like that, yes.
Now,
that's a hypothetical question in a way, because there are always sunspots sort of coming and going.
Now, I might ask you, what was the flavor of CSIRO in those days? You were a young
That's right.
And postgraduate, but what was
it
like?
It was a sort of an intensely active and intensely competitive place in some ways. And Joe Pawsey had the job of sort of reining to some extent, reining back all the young keen fellows like Bolton, Mills and Christensen and so on. They were all contesting for funds, each had their own research groups, and it was an incredibly stimulating establishment in those early days. And I was one of the first people who went in straight from university. All these other chaps had come back from wartime or national laboratory type experience.
Right.
They came in with a lot of very good background techniques at their fingertips, which they could use immediately. So it was a very stimulating atmosphere to be working in at that stage.
Now, how long were you in Australia?
I was there for 2 years, two and a bit, 2 years.
And then how was it that you went to Jodrell then, I guess?
Then I went to Jodrell in the end of 1953. That was when the Mark I was starting to be built. In fact, by the time I got there, the steelwork Mark I was just rising above concrete foundations. I wanted to get some experience outside. I wanted to do a PhD if I could.
Oh, I see.
Get some outside research experience.
And that really couldn't be done in Australia.
That wasn't possible there to get a. We didn't have within Adelaide University facilities for research for PhD at that stage. And I went over to CSIRO, and there were no ways of doing any postgraduate degrees at that stage, which I thought I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And my original plan was to go to the UK for 3 years, do a PhD and go back again, as all my predecessors had done at one stage or another. It didn't turn out that way.
What did you find at Jodrell when you got there? You mentioned the dish, but as far as the group itself, what was going on?
At that stage, there was a good mixture of both radar and radio astronomy. It was a combined set of operations that they were running at that stage. Lovell and J.G. Davis, Greenhow, the two Evanses were all involved in radar work of one sort or another, looking at the moon or meteors. And there was a smaller number of people working on the radio emission, the background radio emission. People like Hanbury Brown was really the main force behind that, with Hazard.
And discrete sources also,
that's
galaxies.
Right. Yes. He had just detected the emission from M31.
Right.
Soon before I had arrived. That was stimulating a lot of interest to see what they could get from ordinary galaxies.
And how was it determined, more or less, what you would work on?
Well, at that stage, I was offered the possibility of working on neutral hydrogen. They were just setting up a receiver at that stage. David Williams, who was doing his PhD.
Right, I've talked to him, so I've heard his
right,
version.
Right. Well, David had, I think,